Philema, Coast to Coast, number 10, July 30, 2005. Another episode of Philema Coast to Coast. I'm John Crow, and it's my goal to bring you the most interesting and entertaining information regarding the spiritual philosophy called Philema. As with the last show, I want to welcome new listeners from iTunes. I'm glad you all are listening, and I hope you find the program worth your time. As I've said before, I don't ask for monetary donations for the show. However, I really do want to receive email and comments from listeners. You can contact the show in three different ways. You can email at podcast@thelemacoast2coast.com. That's coast, T-O, coast.com. Go to the Philema Coast to Coast website, www.thelemacoasttocoast.com, and leave a comment. Or you can join me, Keith418, and a number of other listeners at the new Philema Coast to Coast community blog. This blog is where listeners can ask substantive questions and get long answers that I couldn't give on the show due to time constraints. I've already answered a number of questions about transparency, the OTO leadership, books, and much more. It's free and easy, although you do have to sign up for a free account to post and reply. The link to the community blog can be found on the Philema Coast to Coast website. Regardless, it does not matter how you do it, but please let me know what you think of the show, and especially send questions. Today's show is somewhat a change from our usual format. Last weekend, Keith418 gave a lecture at PAX Templi called Nietzsche for Thelemites. We are fortunate enough to have the talk to present on Philema Coast to Coast. Many thanks to Peggy for recording the show. A few notes about the recording, though. First, it was done from the audience, and as such, the recording quality is rough. I have done what I can to clean it up, and it is certainly listenable, but there are still some points of distortion, especially when the volume goes up, or when the filters have removed copious background noise. There was also a bit of an intro where Keith was chatting with the audience while people were getting settled and the environment set up. I've removed this for time. Because of it, though, the talk seems to start out of nowhere. I assure you that you're getting the full talk. Anyway, here's the lecture. Keith418 talking about Nietzsche for Thelemites.
Well, he talks about in the same kind of context with the same a degree of application and interest. And over time, I've actually really tried to make an effort to do that. And that was one of the things that, you know, my occult teachers really made me do. They said, look, study these people, look at all of them. And I noticed that when I did, like, a presentation on the ancient and accepted, or, you know, ancient and primitive rite of Memphis, everybody was like, yeah, that's cool, that's interesting. Or they were bored or whatever. But no one ever got upset. Or, you know, I would write something about Bon, you know, Tibetan Bon magic, or I would write something about Paul Gauguin, or I would, you know, talk about John Yark, or all these people that would connect with Crowley, and everybody would be like, yeah, that's cool, okay, you know, C.F. Russell, sure, okay, fine. Nietzsche, boom, problem. I would have, like, people on my case immediately, and it's like clockwork. It's like, as soon as I say, oh, Nietzsche, boom, you're an asshole. Boom, you're a fundamentalist. You're a Philemic fundamentalist. And I thought this was interesting, because I'm like, well, wait a minute. You know, if I talk about these other Gnostic saints, no one accuses me of being a Philemic fundamentalist. I mean, I'll own that. You know, if you want to, you know, use that as a label for me, I'll accept that. I'll own that label. But why was Nietzsche triggering that kind of response from people? And I thought that was interesting. And that's kind of why I want to talk about him tonight, because he's pissing people off. And he's really pissing Thelemites off. And things that piss Thelemites off are interesting to me. You know, I'm interested in the thing that gets, like, the really unhappy kind of reaction, because something's going on there. the happy, da-da-da-da-da. Okay, well, that's fine in its place. But what about that? What's making people so upset about Nietzsche? So that is why I want us to look at him, because he is unhappy-making. The other issue with Nietzsche that I think is important, unhappy-making. The thing that I think is interesting to look at Nietzsche is that he enables us to look at a lot of things, some of which could make us happy, some of which could make us unhappy. But I think Nietzsche is interesting as a lens. You know, it's like, what does he help us look at? What does he call our attention to? So, without further ado, I kind of wanted to talk about his relationship to Aleister Crowley. So we'll start with Crowley. Now, why do we start with Crowley? Well, this is Nietzsche for Delamites, right? And I'm going to assume, just for the sake of argument, that everybody in the room is kind of interested in Crowley and will accept the idea that we can start with him. We don't have to end with him. We don't have to agree with him. We can disagree with him. We can find that he's wrong. We can move off of him and make somebody else central at some other point. All those things are possible. But we can start, just for the purpose of this workshop, saying, let's start with Crowley and see what he said. So, I picked out some quotes from Crowley about Nietzsche. And the one that I think is the most profound and the one I would like people to take away from in the course of this, if you take away anything, is Crowley saying, I think that the controversy of the future will be between the law of nature, or of Nietzsche, and that of compassion, or of Shelley. Now, does anyone know where that quote comes from? Anyone locate the book? Nah, any ideas? No? Angel? No? Okay. So, compassion, Shelley, versus nature, and Nietzsche. This is a really interesting kind of controversy. This is the controversy of the future, according to Crowley. So immediately you say to yourself, well, he's just drawing a line in the sand. Where are we on this line? Are we going to side with nature and Nietzsche, or compassion and Shelley? Which one is it going to be? This is actually from Liber 888, which is, as we should know, the Gospel according to St. Bernard Shaw, which is particularly interesting given that Shaw wrote plays like St. Joan and, you know, had this kind of very strange attempt to sort of wed socialism to his sort of bizarre philosophical beliefs. But Shaw was so important to Crowley as a historical figure that he wrote this whole book about him and wrote about him, you know, in response to, you know, to Polema and Crowley's own viewpoint. So, this is a big deal here. I mean, is that really the controversy of the future? Is Crowley just wrong about this? I mean, is this not the controversy? Is it really going to be Pepsi versus Coke? I mean, what's the deal with this? So that struck me as something that was like kind of profoundly interesting and important as a quote. The other quote, which I would also like people to come away from with this, is, strangely enough, another dichotomy. Crowley says, this book, meaning the Book of the Law, announces a new dichotomy in human society. There is the master and there is the slave, the noble and the serf, the lone wolf and the herd. And then, in parentheses, he says, Nietzsche may be regarded as one of our prophets, to a much less extent, De Gobineau.
De Gobineau?
De Gobineau. Okay. Nietzsche makes people unhappy when I talk about him in relationship to Crowley on the internet. I will not risk the unhappiness I will get if I talk about De Gobineau. We're not even going to go there, right? So not even going to go there. Not a good topic to discuss. We're not even going to talk about him now here. You can know him. You can go back on the internet later tonight and go, De Gobineau. But I think that this is a really interesting point. Crowley is not saying that Nietzsche here is a saint in the Gnostic Church. He's saying he is a prophet. Why is Crowley saying Nietzsche is a prophet of Thelema? Because Nietzsche recognizes this new dichotomy in human society. Right? So, if we're going to see Nietzsche as a saint or Nietzsche as a prophet in Crowley's terms, why did Crowley see him this way? Because he is making this dichotomy between slaves and masters, between nobles and serfs, between lone wolves and the herd. Again, this is a choice now. So if we're going to think along with Crowley, we're going to say, well, which side are we on here? If we agree with Crowley, just for the sake of argument, and we're thinking with him, then this is, goes back to this issue again. Nietzsche is the good guy because he is actually making this dichotomy reference, and this is why he is a prophet. Not for any other reason. Alright? This is tricky. Okay, so, just to back up a little bit, why didn't Crowley push Nietzsche more on his students? If he says this kind of shit, did he make anyone read Nietzsche? Was he pushing Nietzsche? Did we have, if we did the AA curriculum, did we have to read Nietzsche? No. There's none of that in there. Why not? I have a suspicion. The first suspicion is that while Crowley was alive, people knew who Nietzsche was. He was a big figure. You know, Marx, Nietzsche, Freud. These are the three big figures, the late 1800s, early 1900s. So making people read Nietzsche might have been redundant. Crowley kind of talks in a lot of his writings as if you already know who Nietzsche is. If you're reading Magic Without Tears, and he says this, he's assuming you know who Nietzsche is. When I was in college, I read Nietzsche because I was a philosophy student, and I read him in high school. I knew, I studied him, and when I read nasty critics who hated Crowley saying, this is just warmed over Nietzsche, I didn't agree with them, but I knew why they were saying that. How many people have seen Crowley compared as just like a copycat of Nietzsche? Does this happen? Right. Have you seen this, like, nasty books?
In his contemporary, yeah.
Right. He sucks because he's just ripping Nietzsche off. Like, I mean, I think John Simmons says something like this in his biography. So enough people knew who Nietzsche was to see that. I don't think Crowley really wanted people to draw that kind of comparison. So I don't think he wanted his students to be reading these books going like, wait a minute, this is pretty much the same thing Crowley is telling us himself. Now, Crowley wrote a piece called The Vindication of Nietzsche. Has anyone read this? How could you not have? It appeared in the 1993 Kalima Watch calendar, which is where I got it off the internet. Okay? Come on, folks. People weren't reading that. You know, it's got Bill Heidrich's detergent on it. Okay. And in the course of this, Crowley says, I quote it in preference to Nietzsche, and what he's quoting is really nasty passages from the Book of the Law. The third chapter stuff you do not really feel comfortable about when new people read and start asking us questions. You know, let Mary be broken, blah, blah, blah. All this stuff is kind of, that's what he's quoting. And he says, I quote it in preference to Nietzsche, not only because Nietzsche has penetrated from Prussia to Plymouth and is quoted in Streatham and in Stuttgart, it's like in suburban areas all over the place, but because it is simpler than Nietzsche because there is no possibility of misrepresenting the doctrine. Because it is not German or Slavonic, but universal, the battle cry of what may yet become a new and terrible theocracy. All right, so why wasn't he quoting Nietzsche in the Vindication of Nietzsche piece? He was quoting from the Book of the Law. Why was he doing it? Well, he said it was simpler and people wouldn't confuse the doctrine. That doesn't mean that the doctrine is different from what Nietzsche was giving us. It's just simpler, and you can't confuse it. So Crowley's actually saying, it's not different, it's just better, because it's more direct. Not different, just more direct. Okay, if you have a hostility to Nietzsche at this point, and if you're saying, I kind of like the compassion side of this better, if we're going to make this, then this is an interesting thing to consider. Because Crowley, is making a very, very close comparison between his own work, his own thoughts, and what Nietzsche had to say. Okay? So, now, I'm going to say, this is a little story that I think indicates why I think this stuff is important. If everyone's sort of getting that kind of creepy, like, I don't know about this, I don't know where this is going sort of thing. When I was a little kid, there was a house near me where these artists lived, quote artists, and they were sort of hippies and friends of my dad, who was also an artist. And my dad brought one of his other friends, Walter Torello, with him. Walter was a contractor, and he brought them over to meet this hippie artist family. And they walked through the hall of the family's house into the living room, and Walter, the contractor, immediately started backing up towards the wall like this, with this look of terror on his face. And my father said, Walter, what's the matter? Because Walter was scared to death. He said, they've removed the bearing partition. Okay. Now, some of the guys here are laughing. Some of the guys, I didn't know what a bearing partition was. I had to look it up on the internet. What is a bearing partition? And what it is when you're building a house, here's the first floor and here's the second floor. You put a partition in along the first floor to balance the weight of the second floor on it, and the hippies had decided, oh, we're artists! We just get rid of this partition, it's hurting our space, it's not on the light, just get rid of it. So they just, destroyed the partition. They just knocked it down and carried it out, probably threw it in the backyard. So, the rubble just went away. So they didn't think this was a problem because they didn't understand how the whole house worked. But Walter, who was the contractor, knew that there was very little keeping that first floor up. It could fall at any time, which was why he was backing his ass back up against the wall as fast as he could. Now, what does this have to do with Nietzsche? I'm going to suggest, just for people's, entertainment value, that the OTO, the Thelemic Society as a whole, like everything, not just the OTO, but other Thelemic groups out there, have sort of done the old partition removal thing without thinking about it with Nietzsche. And that Nietzsche and his ideas are actually a bearing partition holding up the upper floors of our structures, both physical and metaphysical. If you'll permit me that. And that, in fact, when we see cave-ins occurring and huge shattering crises and problems, often it's because a bunch of hippies said, hey, we don't really need that bearing partition. Let's get it out of here without realizing actually the structure is kind of based on it. So I'm going to throw out that analogy. So let's start with some of the things that Nietzsche taught. And his basic teaching, and I'm going to rip through this really quickly this time because I spent too much time on it the last time, is a critique of idealism. What is idealism? Okay, real quick. The ancient Greeks asked, in the post-pre-Socratic era, how do we know this is a chair? Right? Well, because we can tell that this is a chair and that's a chair, but we can tell that Dan isn't a chair. Well, how do we know this? How does our knowledge work this way? Well, to keep a long story short, this is the world of becoming. This is the world of particulars, where there's particular chairs and particular fans all over the place. And above that world of particulars, is the world of forms. And in the world of forms, archetypes exist of the perfect chair. And we all have a dim kind of understanding of what that perfect chair is, right? And because we have that dim sort of understanding from maybe, we were once there or we're not seeing it clearly, but we have this kind of vague idea, we can tell the difference, between a chair and a fan. Because somewhere, up above us is this perfect form of a chair. So the next question is, well, how do we know the difference between one chair and two chairs? Well, because there's a form not just for chair, but a form for one, the number one. There's a form. It's just perfectly one thing. How do we tell what something's good or something's bad? Because up there, in the world of forms, is a form for the perfect good. And what Socrates started asking people annoying questions, the general theory is Plato, his student, came up with the solution, which is, let's set up this world of forms and particulars. The cool world, where nothing ever changes, and where everything is shining and perfect and pure, is the world of forms. The crappy world of particulars is down here where everything's kind of a mess, things come into being, things leave, right? That's the world of particulars. Now, the philosopher is the smart guy because he can travel up into the world of forms while fully conscious, check it out, look at what's going on, see it, and then come back down and tell everybody else, hey, you fools, stop watching TV, stop playing Nintendo, there's this world of forms which is superior. This is basic Platonic theory. Okay? Easy to understand? Fairly. Now, you can read all the Plato dialogues and really get into this. And Plato criticizes his own system. He's not just preaching this. And he shows how there are problems with it and contradictions and paradoxes. But nonetheless, in general terms, this is how Platonism works. Well, Nietzsche looked at this and said, it's interesting because this is Plato. Like, he's really smart and these books are really intense. But most people just could not handle the density of Plato. So what did they turn it into instead? Well, we could have this be creation, and this be heaven, and this be not just the good or the one, but God. And who is the person who goes back and forth between these two worlds and sort of shows us how everything works? Jesus. Yay! So in fact, Christianity was Plato for beginners, Plato for idiots. And Nietzsche says this very directly. That's what it was all about. And the problem with this is that this is a weak-ass way of looking at reality, according to Nietzsche. That the only people that kind of get invested in this model are lamos who cannot cut it down here in the world of the particulars, and instead are trying to convince everyone, hey, this world where I'm a loser and I'm not doing well, this is not the real world. You people are foolish. There's another world that I can go through. That you can. It's beautiful and wonderful and perfect and pure, and the values of that world are more important than the values of this world. So even if I'm losing, even if you guys won't pick me for kickball, that doesn't matter because I can get up into this better world. And loser people throughout history who have been struggling and failing in the regular world that we all have to live in have been running away to find this better world that they can then use to beat people up with. You know, it's like, you don't pick me for your kickball team? Well, God is going to get mad at you because God likes me because I'm more invested in this higher system. So sooner or later, you're going to get punished. Or you should feel terrible because you're violating the rules of heaven by treating me badly down here. So now suddenly, I didn't get picked by the kickball team, but I have power over the people who didn't pick me. They'll pick me later, but they didn't pick me, so I now have power over them. And Nietzsche thought this was a loser system. So he basically attacked the entire idea of this hierarchy and said, this is all just crap. So we have the real world down here, and according to Nietzsche, nothing up here. Now, how does this create problems for occultists and Thelemites? Okay, it does. It creates problems. We may be saying to ourselves, shit, you know, Nietzsche may be onto something. I've had people guilt trip me like that. I've had to put up with that crap before. You know, some of these, like, fairy tale worlds that people talk about to try to guilt trip me, I know that's bullshit, right? You know, I know that's crap. You may be thinking that in the back of your mind. And a lot of this sounds a lot like trolling in a certain sense, but it creates kind of a problem for us. What is the problem? Well, now, I'm going to think about what the problem is. After Plato came Aristotle, who's kind of like, yeah, world of form, that's great. Let's actually start looking at birds and fish and come up with stuff that's down here. And there was a big conflict between Plato and Aristotle. Aristotle sort of worked better. Plato kind of receded, but made a comeback. Kind of like Paula Abdul. And we all know that the comeback was Neoplatonism. And Neoplatonism were all the people who were like, no, Plato's really onto something. And I can do drugs, and I can do rituals, and I can take you, little girl, up into the heavenly world again. I will show you tricks, right? So Neoplatonism caught on among who? Who is Neoplatonism popular with? Hello, occultists, magicians, sorcerers, people like us. So Gnostics, of course, just took this shit and ran with it. And Gnostics, to me, always seemed to me to be like kind of like the people who got the beginner's guide to Platonism, which was Christianity, and said, you know what, there's got to be more. And they went and looked at the appendix and was like, okay, yeah, we got to go back up. So they kind of went back up the ladder into Platonism. And if you look at the Nag Hammadi Library, there are Platonic dialogues that are falling apart in that book. Because they were like using that along with everything else. Gospel of Thomas, got it. You know? Gospel according to Timothy, got it. You know? Origin of the World, got it. You got the Plato? Oh yeah, I got that too. Right? This is sort of like, you know, everyone's OTO paperwork collections in the Nag Hammadi Library. So, you know, so that's a big part of our trip. As magicians and Thelemites and occultists, you know, Neoplatonism, Gnosticism, that's a big deal. Now, the Gnostics took this and said, okay, not only is there this cool world of heaven and forms, but all the creatures living up there have wild names, right? And they just started naming all of them. And the guy who's running the show down here, who is keeping us from getting picked for the kickball team, is the Demiurge. Ooh, he's really awful. He's bad. And all of magic is really about getting around the Demiurge, right? Like, so nature, the world of the Demiurge, is horrible, right? Existence is just awful. This world of the particulars is bad, right? The Gnostics, the ones that hated the world, they really were bitter. Right? And these people, like, give regular Christians who, like, say the devil is the king of this world, they give them a run for their money. Okay? So this is an important part of our whole trip, right? We're the Gnostic Catholic Church. You guys just did the Gnostic Mass. So does Nietzsche's critique of this ideal world create a problem for us? I mean, I thought about doing this lecture today, and I was like, okay, what is the problem for us? Here is the problem. Right? 777. What is 777 but a description of the ideal world? And how to get there? In each stage. So what? If we like really get into Nietzsche and Crowley is right, Nietzsche is really important, we just have to kick 7-7 to the curb? Doesn't this create a problem for us? What is 777 but a hierarchy? Is Keter better than Malkuth? I mean, everyone's trying to get up the tree of life. I never met anyone in my entire time in the occult community who was trying to get down. Did you ever meet anyone who's like, I'm in Vena and I really want to be in Tiferet? I mean, there are people who you might say, Larry is in Hokma and he really, really needs to get laid to get into Netzach. But in general, people want to go up because there's this hierarchy here where Malkuth is for the babies, you know, like with the Golden Dawn. You know, if you're probationer, neophyte in the Golden Dawn, you're in Malkuth, you're baby. I'm above you.
Malkuth is Plato's
grave. Right, I'm above you. So you laugh at the people below you, ha ha ha, they have not got mysteries, right? And the whole mystery religion trip of Gnosticism is based on the leaders being way up here, you know, in the cool kingdom they've created for themselves and looking down at the people, you know, trying to bring them up. You know, oh, we're not looking down, we're not laughing at them. No one in the OTO ever laughs at anyone in the lower degrees or makes jokes about them being in the microwave or anything like that. I mean, we're trying to, like, you know, bring them up, right? But whatever, and we're doing it out of pure selflessness, you know, to advance them. But that's, this is our kind of structure here. So, yeah, we get into Nietzsche, but isn't that going to cause some problems with 777? Okay, so, what are the solutions? Now, interestingly enough, we go back to Nietzsche, and we get some answers. Nietzsche hated Christianity. Christianity is for weaklings, the people who do not get picked. Who are the strong people who do not need Christianity? They are the manly and fun-loving pagans. Okay, now we're back in Llewellyn Books land, you know, that aisle where all the books are $3, right? You know, it's like, ooh, all the Llewellyn books are on sale. Owen Ravenwolf, right? We're back with the pagans. Not so fast. Because Nietzsche says, we, meaning himself, are probably the first to grasp what a pagan faith is. To have to imagine higher creatures than man, but beyond good and evil. To have to consider all being higher as also being immoral. Oh. So now, hierarchy itself has not been eliminated here. There is a 777 hierarchy. And there is beings higher than man. Nietzsche's suggesting that there are. What's the problem? They're not very nice. Okay? So this creates difficulties. Because Nietzsche is saying, yeah, you know, there are creatures higher than men. There are also higher men. There are human beings that are higher than the run-of-the-mill person. What's the problem with them? Not nice. They don't care if you don't get picked on the kickball team. They're not going to be nice to you. So there's a hierarchy here that remains, but it's not very nice. Is this the Llewellyn pagan system? No. And one of the things that Nietzsche points out that is one of his classic quotes, he says, terribleness is part of greatness. Let us not deceive ourselves. Now, what does that seem relevant to from a quote I just read from Crowley? How does Crowley describe his new theocracy? Immediately, when you say theocracy in relationship to OTO or Thelema, everybody should be just like, yeah. You know, let's say, that's not what we are. Don't be separate. The Khomeini's. This is what, you know, Jerry Falwell wants. We're not theocracy. Crowley's saying, hey, it could be a new, a great and terrible theocracy. It says great and terrible. Terrible and great. Now, look, Nietzsche is saying, hey, greatness Yeah, you can have greatness. What's the problem with it? It's going to be terrible. Does this remind us of anything in Crowley's own writing? Well, what? As you go up the tree of life, do things get easier or do they get tougher? They get tougher. Like Lieberchef, not a lot of fun. You know, bad things happen. It's not good. So Nietzsche seems to be right along with Crowley saying, yeah, there are higher things. Yeah, of course there are. There's a hierarchy. But it's not a hierarchy of niceness. You know, this is sort of not the bodhisattva hierarchy where bodhisattvas are in a race to be the last person to be enlightened. You know, it's like, no, after you. No, I have to stay here until everybody's through. Come on, no, I'm waiting for you. No. They have this argument about it. I don't see that energy here. Could be wrong. I don't see it. So, another quote. Man is beast and super beast. The higher man is inhuman and superhuman. These belong together. With every increase of greatness and height in man, height up the tree, there is also an increase of depth and terribleness. One ought not to desire the one without the other, or rather, the more radically one desires the one, the more radically one achieves perfectly the other. So, if you want to be a great magician, and a powerful person, and a higher human being, what are you going to have to take on? You're going to have to take on a lot of terrible power. Terribleness. You're going to look terrible to other people. Do we find this in the holy books? I think we do. Right? Do we find this in real life? Think about some of the absolute great teachers that we have. They are terrible, horrible, pains in the butt. You know? And the more important they are, the more influence they have, the more terrible they get. So even if we were to say, hey, you know, Jesus, look, we met Jesus, we went back in time, Mr. Peabody's time machine, the chairman, we went back, we met Jesus. He's really not a terrible guy. He's a really good guy. We were impressed. We had lunch with him. Terrible table manners, but not really an awful guy. Nietzsche would say, yeah, but look what he did. He may not have been that bad a guy, but Christianity is awful. It's like a mess. Millions of people murdered, killing, seals and crofts, whatever that song, you know. How many people have died, and, you know, it's just horrible. Crusades, everything else. So do people get this? This to me seems significant, all right? Now, the next issue is hierarchy in general. When Nietzsche attacks this idealism, this system of idealism, he's not really attacking hierarchy per se. And recently, I was at Mose, and I went up to the Heidegger-Nietzsche section to buy used books, and I came across this text called Why We Are Not Nietzscheans. And it's by 7 really snotty French writers who translated into English, and they all spend a huge amount of time bitching about Nietzsche in very French ways. And I like buying books attacking people that I really like. Because I've learned, you know, from Gnostics that you read those texts backwards. You know, Hippolytus attacks the Gnostics. We read it backwards, we discover all this great shit. Hey, you made Hippolytus a saint. You know, he gave us some good data. You didn't like it? Well, it doesn't matter. You know, St. Irenaeus, all these early Christian heresiologists for years before the Nagamani Library turned up, they were the best source for Gnostic stuff. So we read them backwards. You know, Craig Penblecker, former principal down on the peninsula, wrote this book, Attacking the OTO, Blood on the Altar. I love that book. I told everyone to buy it. It's got great shit about us. You know, I will say Jesus is right. Love your enemies because they'll tell you things your friends won't. You know, so there's like good shit in this. So I said, I've got to pick this book up. And one of the things that this book points out is the French are, you know, why they're not Nietzscheans. No one can be a Nietzschean. Nietzsche's grumpy. But they say at one point, no one can be a Nietzschean because he keeps contradicting himself. Okay? And this is true. You can find Nietzsche saying a whole bunch of different things because he's thinking constantly. He's writing stuff out. He wrote voluminously, and he contradicts himself a bunch. But they also said, despite that, he keeps coming back to the issue of hierarchy. And Nietzsche believes really strongly in hierarchy. What does that mean? He doesn't believe in equality. Because hierarchy is the opposite of equality. If everybody is equal, there can't be no hierarchy. If there's a hierarchy, it means everybody isn't equal. Think about that. Does this create a problem for Thelemites? Okay? Yes, it does. Because most people in the Thelema community think Thelema makes everyone equal. It's like there's this huge equality. The will, you know, makes everyone equal. We're all stars. Whatever the rap is, whatever the interpretation is, it seems like it is a real push for equality. But the bulimic system itself, as Crowley set it up, has serious hierarchies, right? The magus is not the equal to the probationer. Nope. The neophyte is not the equal to the adeptus minore. So Crowley seems to me to be in keeping with Nietzsche in saying there is a hierarchy. And if you want to see Crowley attacking the idea of equality, he does it throughout all of his texts. I found quote after quote after quote. Because all of these nerdy people are entering stuff into the internet, you can do a search and just find Crowley attacking the idea of equality over and over again, just as much, if not, you know, pretty much in exactly the same terms as Nietzsche did. So what does this mean, right? So which side are we on now? Again, are we homo hieraticus or homo equalis? Which one are we going to get behind? So Crowley sets up a hierarchy, and Nietzsche sets up a hierarchy. They look very similar. Because they just made the same dichotomy. Crowley is saying there is the herd, and there is the lone wolf. The master, the slave. Right? Isn't this the same basic duality hierarchy that Nietzsche's giving us? Yeah, that's why Nietzsche was a prophet, according to Crowley. So now, if we disagree with this and we go, oh, no, 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 you know, we don't need, no, 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 get rid of this. Aren't we going to pull down a partition? That's what I'm suggesting. And I think a lot of times the conflicts people have is that they're operating a system which is based on a hierarchy, based on inequality, not equality, you know, based on these sorts of terms, that is contrary to their basic values. They believe in equality. They believe no one's better than anyone else. They think the lemma is all about everybody being equal and not about people being different in this manner. So, why study Nietzsche? He's making this really clear. Crowley's going along with it. But when I bring it up on the internet, everybody flips out. It's interesting. Okay. So, let's say for the nonce that we go back in time to, you know, the 1800s, 1700s, 1800s. What's happening during that period of time? It's a fascinating period. There is the invention of electricity, right? You know, Benjamin Franklin and his kite. There are people making inventions all over the place. They're doing microscopes. They're finding out this. They're finding out that. Copernicus decides that, you know what? The Earth is going around the sun and not the other way, right? So there's been this huge scientific revolution. What does this really do? According to Nietzsche, it destroys the idea of God. Because back in the days before the scientific revolution, you know, we thought the world was made in 7 days, and most people really believed this, and if you didn't, you kept your mouth shut. But, you know, everything was sort of this faith-based community, and now suddenly science has taken over, and does science care about good and evil? Does science care about right and wrong? No. Does science care about God? Not that much. Right? Ultimate questions, Big Bang Theory and everything, yeah, they're interested in that. That's not God. You know, guy with a white beard giving, you know, playing with the Virgin Mary and setting up Jesus, that's not what science is really interested in. They are interested in things like carbon dating and, you know, really looking at this stuff. But science can be put to any kind of use whatsoever. I mean, we can spend a huge amount of money on scientific research to create vaccines. Or we can spend it on to make plastic flowers, right? Both of those things are possible. Science doesn't care. So Nietzsche saw the whole faith in Christianity slowly being eliminated. So when you get rid of God up here, and you've already dispensed with Plato, what gets put in its place? This friend of mine pointed out that, like, starting in the 1700s, people sort of got desperate to put something else in God's place. Because it's like, God's dead. You know, we found the body. Science killed him. We all were involved. Nietzsche points this out very much. It's like, hey, we all did it. So we all bought into the scientific stuff. So we're all responsible. Who is going to sit in his office? Because he's still, the office space is still there. The structure is still there. So who's going to sit there? So some philosophers and big heavy thinkers were saying things like, the spirit. Not quite God. But come on, the spirit. No, No. No, science wasn't buying the spirit. What else? Progress. History. What is this dominating thing that creates everything? It's history. It's progress. Not satisfying. Just not coming up with it. It's not working for me. So, Nietzsche ultimately says, as God dies, the herd, the mass numbers of people, come to fill his place. And the herd values that had been kind of created by Christianity and sustained by it become the main thing. So what are some examples of herd values? Well, the herd is more important than the individual. And Nietzsche tells us the fundamental error is placing the goal in the herd and not in the individual person. What does that sound like? Sounds like dilemma, right? It's not do what's best for everybody else shall be the whole of the law, right? Do what's best for the group shall be the whole of the law. You know, these are herd values, and these are the values that, you know, people have. So to kind of get a grip on herd values a little more, I wanted us to play a game called Design a Slave. Okay? So let's pretend that we are all evil, slave-making creators. We can adopt the Nation of Islam mythology, Dr. Yacoub, who created white people, total bastard. If we're going to program and create slaves, what kind of qualities do we want to see in those slaves? How will we program them?
Total obedience.
Total obedience. Okay, so they basically obey. They're programmed to obey. Okay, that's easy enough. What else?
Resistance to free thought.
Well, that's
depth of thought.
Okay, they're shallow, basically shallow people, right, with shallow ideas. Don't think about anything too deeply. That's good. Shallow people. Now,
not too smart.
Right, not too smart. And that could be a problem later. But here's the issue with shallow. We don't want them to think deep thoughts. We want them to stay away from deep thoughts. Yeah.
Total buy-in to what they're being commanded.
Right, they're invested in whatever the system is. Yeah. So they're very invested. Okay, now, some other things.
Low pain threshold.
Low pain threshold, right. So it will be easy for us, if they're doing something wrong, we can just go over and flick them.
Right. Low comfort and they run from
But they can't be too comfort seeking, because if they are, they can cause problems and not work hard enough. Working hard involves some pain, so we can't have them be too. But in that context, yeah, we want them to be comfortable. We want them to seek comfort and not be willing to be courageously enough to accept vast amounts of pain. You know, moderate. You know, if we can control them with just a little flick, that's what we want.
I don't know if this makes sense or not, but just to build on that, a morality that does not go beyond punishment and reward.
Okay, yes, so a simple kind of, like, zero-sum morality kind of thing. That's pretty easy. Okay, but here's another one. Do we want them to be confident?
No.
We want them to be insecure and guilty.
The guilt.
Okay.
Limited imagination.
So, guilty... No imagination, right, but we want them to feel guilty all the time. Why? Because they will punish themselves, and we will be freed up to take pictures of our black dogs and not have to worry about punishing them, right? Which is what we want. We want them to go and serve us and feel guilty and just be totally guilty. What else do we want from them?
Myopic.
What?
Myopic.
Totally can't see anything beyond their own immediate environment. And the other issue that we really want is we want them to be more concerned about the group than about themselves as individuals. And here's why. I'm on a plantation, right? And a hurricane is coming. And my slaves are all worried about it. And one slave says, you know, I could actually gather everybody together and move them towards the caves, and I could save everybody. Or I could just run to the cave myself and save myself. Well, if he chooses or she chooses to do that, I am out every single slave that dies in the hurricane. I am screwed, and I have to go buy more from my other Dr. Yacoub-like friends. So I actually want them to be more concerned about each other than themselves as individuals. Because if they are, they will guilt trip each other. They will work to conform to the mass number of what they're doing. And I won't have to worry about one individual taking off. So the idea of one person sacrificing himself, if one slave decides to sacrifice himself for all the rest of the slaves, do I do better as the master? You bet I do. Right? The other thing I think we've just about I just about covered that, but the guilty conscience, and if they're looking for a reward, when is the best place for them to find their reward?
In their work.
When they're in their work or when they're dead.
When they're dead.
Because that way, I will not have to reward them with anything, right? They can go to heaven, God will take care of them, I will have their work here on earth, they can have this whole fantasy land about how, even though they're slaves here, they're going to do better in the afterlife, and I will teach them this platonic escape route, you know, to whatever limited extent it will be, and they will all be fine. They will accept their lot because their reward is elsewhere, and I can take advantage of their labor here.
Low expectations, I
think. Right. Low expectations. Well, some of these things you're going to see get built in over time. If you're a guilt-ridden person with no imagination, are you going to have high expectations? Probably not. Okay, so a lot of this stuff, if we do the programming right, they will program each other. I mean, you know, all of us are infinitely lazy and have better things to do. We do not want to run around and bother the slaves all the time. We want them to just do their thing and leave us alone so that we can go off and take pictures of flies. Okay, so what if we run into a problem? And we start getting a few slaves that, try as we might, maybe they just... they're courageous, you know? They don't. Maybe they don't mind the pain so much. Maybe they're really good-looking slaves, you know? Maybe they're smarter than we tried to make them stupid with their diet or whatnot, but they still, a few of them, they're fucking the system up. They're still a little smarter. What do we do with those guys? Because they're going to cause a problem. Now, we could kill them, but then we are in trouble because we're out of slave, and especially a fairly hard-working one. So we don't want to get rid of any slaves we don't have to, because that just means we have to buy more, which means we can buy fewer clothes for our dolls. So my argument here is that we make those slaves the controllers of the other slaves, right? So, okay, you know, Stevie slave, you're like really smart, you're really hardworking, you're really courageous. You know, and I know, that you're better than the rest of these idiots, and I'm not going to deny it. So guess what? Your job, you're watching out over all of them. You get to join the Electoral College. Okay, so that's my argument as to how we do this. And Nietzsche critiques this entire idea, right? He goes through and shows how all of these things happen and how people run their slave numbers on each other. And the argument that I'm going to use for this, it's very kind of practical. Who here considers themselves a very timely person? Get to work on time every day. Try to stay on time. I know this is kind of controversial within the bulimic community because everybody's on bulimic people time. Most of the time they're late and stuff. But how many people like actually are really like trying to be on time? I will confess, I am a total time freak. I am a total, you know, I always want to get on time. I always want to try to be early. Early to me is better than being on time. Being on time is late. That's my attitude. And it pisses me off when other people are not on time all the time. And I thought about this because if you think about it, if you're a good middle-class person, you have to be on time for your job. Because if you don't, you will be fired. And a lot of times people have this problem because they want to say, well, you know, if I show up on time, that shows that I'm, like, looking to you for approval. So I'm going to be late. You're going to have to suffer with me being late. And, you know, it's a sort of passive-aggressive kind of time management thing. And if that happens too much, we're just going to be like, you're gone. We're going to get somebody here that's on time. And I used to work at a job where time issues were a constant problem. And we say, look, we're not kidding. This may be a hinky place, but you have to show up on time or we will fire you. And a few times, because I was a manager, I had to send people home if they were like 10 minutes late. Nope, sorry, 10 minutes late. You were told to be here at 2. You're gone. Go home. Like, I don't get to work today. I don't get paid. That's right. We told you you had to be on time. We warned you to be on time next time. And either they learned to be on time or they quit. But the big issue was that I personally was really invested in getting them to work on time. Now, was there a discipline issue at work that no work would have gotten done if everybody was wandering 10, 15 minutes, a half an hour late? Yes, that was definitely an issue. But as I examine my own values about it, it's like, if I have to be on time, everybody else has to be on time. And if I'm going to be conscientious, everybody else has to be. And this is really an attitude that helps if you have a bunch of slaves. Because their attitude will be, hey, I had to pick up after that guy, so you have to pick up after him too. You know, and equality actually starts to become part of the deal here. No one is better than anyone else. Do you think you're better than me? You're not. You're a slave too. Get with the program. And this kind of manipulation is a big part of this issue. So, we have a problem now, because God died, spirit didn't work, progress didn't work, history didn't work, and now the herd has kind of like become its own justification. But it has no justification, because it has no hierarchy. It has destroyed the hierarchy. Equality says none of this stuff can exist, no one's better than everyone else. Where are the goals? Where are the values? What do people want? Well, the herd is sort of like confused. And Nietzsche says, if you look around and go outside, you're going to see slaves all over the place, but they don't know what they're doing. They're slaves, but they have no project. They have no idea. And this is modernity. And the result of this, often enough, is nihilism. People just start going, nothing's worth working out. There is no God. There are no values. It's all a mess. Now, when Crowley first started publishing his thing, did he think society was in chaos? Yeah, pretty much. Did he think the shit was going to hit the fan pretty soon with a complete collapse of Western civilization? He did. And I've seen letters that he wrote during World War I while he was in New York where he's telling people, folks are getting interested in the OTO because they see everything's coming to a smash really soon. So they think our idea is going to save all of Western civilization. I think he really believed that. But a lot of it was because these values, when they suddenly come into play, just create nihilism. And Nietzsche points out, these values, if you take them far enough, they're destructive. What's an example of this? Okay, we want our slaves to be honest, right? This is a big thing, and it's hooked into our guilt, right? They have to be honest. So it's like, Jim, you're my slave. Stevie, you're my slave. Barney, you're my slave. Did you guys goof off in the field yesterday and not do your work? Yeah, we did. No. Now, why are they telling me that? They're afraid of pain. They know they're going to get in trouble. But honesty is so important to them that they have to tell me the truth. Because we bred that into them. That is one of the big issues, right? So, if we take the honesty long enough, and everyone is really truthful, they're going to realize, I'm not happy with my life. This situation isn't any good. Why are you the boss? What's your... I'm not finding your rationale, good anymore, Keith. Why are you running things? So honesty, if taken to extremes, which it tends to, becomes self-destructive. So Christianity, which told everyone they had to be honest, right? That's a big part of Christianity, bred science. And science, trying to be truthful, said Christianity is stupid and doesn't make any sense. So Christianity just self-destructed because its value taken to its highest extreme destroyed it. And this creates nihilism. So, the highest values that people have are what? Moral values, right? Are these values more important over here to people in their real lives than what their favorite color is? Pretty much. I mean, truth, honesty, commitment, being honest, that's more important than whether you like the color brown or the color orange. And Nietzsche tells us our highest values are moral values. Is this one of the reasons why people get upset with me when I talk about Nietzsche and Crowley? Yes, it is. Because if your highest value is equality, and Crowley is telling you, that's stupid, your highest value is being attacked. It's not that brown is not a great color, or orange isn't that cool, or Three's Company wasn't a funny show. These are really serious issues. So, why do Thelemites have to look at Nietzsche? Well, we have to figure out what our values are. Are these our values? Are we still buying into them? Do we have to in order to get along with everybody else? Nietzsche is telling us, find out what your freaking values are. And where did they come from? Did they come from the fact that they appealed to you because you did not get picked at kickball? Where did these values arise? And one of Nietzsche's most important books is The Genealogy of Morals, where he asks people to go back and find out where all their values came from. Now, we're kidding around with creating slaves here. And unlike the Nation of Islam, I do not really believe that this is how, people were created. But nonetheless, there's something to be said for this, right? So do people actually spend a lot of time looking at where their values come from? Or do they just accept whatever their values are and just say, oh, that's natural, that's who I am, that's me. They didn't come from anywhere, they're just part of who I am. I don't think that's legitimate. Crowley asks us to do yoga, to do magic, to study what our values are. You know, he thinks that society imposes its values on us. In his famous chapter about the bed of Procrustes and Liber Alla, he says, you know, you're all being fitted to this bed of Procrustes, which is the guy from Greek mythology who would stretch everybody or chop their limbs off so they fit in one bed. Well, these values, do they fit you? Or are you just trying to struggle to like wrap your way into them because everybody wants you to, and because that's, you were born, you know, in a certain time, in a certain country, with a certain economic system being run by certain people, and you're just pretty much going along with the plan. Now, Crowley is telling you to start evaluating that, but I don't know if everyone really is. And Nietzsche sort of forces you to say, hey, is this really what the values, are these values really good? Are they really helpful? Are they really doing what they're supposed to do? So, I think that's interesting. Now, some of you are going to say, okay, Keith, I admit that these values didn't come from God, right? The Ten Commandments, right? Didn't happen that way. Didn't break down that way. God did not give us our values. But, nonetheless, you know, we've gotten rid of God. Maybe we put the herd, the mass number of people up where he used to be, but things are not that bad. There is a sort of morality in the post-God universe. What is it? Secular humanism, right? It's like, hey, you know, this is the NPR is not like really religious, but it has values. Where did those values come from? The Democratic Party is not like super spiritual, but it has party. It has values. Where did they come from? So I think that, you know, if you look at this, a lot of people say Thelema is perfectly amenable to these sort of post-Christian values, right? Where, all right, you know, we don't really believe that much in God anymore, but we're spiritual vaguely, and we have these sort of values that we use in a democratic society to get along with each other. Is this the same thing as what, you know, Nietzsche would say? Are these higher values that are also terrible? Or are they higher values that are kind of lower? I don't think this works too well. I mean, I think that both Crowley and Nietzsche really didn't like socialism. They didn't really like putting the herd in that top person position. And they were both critical of what the goals were. You know, what kind of goals do you have here? So this kind of opens up some questions. This is kind of interesting. All right. Does anyone have any questions at this point about any of this stuff so far? Okay. I'm actually going to skip this section because we're running a little late, and instead I'm going to go on to post-Nietzsche. Okay? I think Nietzsche is really important to study, but I think he's really interesting to study in terms of what comes after him. And I think Martin Heidegger, who spent 10 years studying Nietzsche, actually offers us some really interesting ways to look back at Nietzsche and figure out what his effect was. So Heidegger, who spent 10 years at least studying Nietzsche, he says we should study Nietzsche the way we study Aristotle. Not in the exact same way, but in very much the same manner, where you take every line, you talk about it, you translate it, you look at what it means, and you move on to the next one. I mean, he was like a fanatic about doing this. And he says, let's assume, for the sake of argument, that Nietzsche was right. God died. Metaphysics collapsed. Just gone. There is no metaphysics anymore. There is no heavenly world. The hierarchy was shattered. It's all gone. What happened to it? And Heidegger tells us metaphysics, this huge system that we used to have with, you know, Thomistic stuff from the Catholic Church and Plato and this whole way of looking at things, got reified. It moved from the spirit world into the material world. Into what? Oh, our good little blinking buddy over here. That's where metaphysics is now. It's in technology. So metaphysics went from these sort of cloud in the sky laws down to actual technological artifacts, which have metaphysics kind of tucked into them and are being run by metaphysics because there are certain laws that are involved in the creation of the universe and matter and the way things are tied together that went into creating our little boombox here, right? And if we didn't know what they were, we couldn't have created it. So Heidegger tells us that in the post-Nietzschean world, there is no metaphysics, but that period of no metaphysics is going to last as long as metaphysics did. So we had metaphysics from like Plato on to Nietzsche, and now we're going to be from Nietzsche on to whoever without it. Where is it going to be? And Heidegger looks at some of the problems of the modern world and says, you know, Plato is really right. Because, you know, Nietzsche was really right, and we've got nothing yet. You know, it's a mess. Technology's taking over. We have, you know, what's going on? And in a really great section, he says, in the present historical situation, accordance can only mean having the courage for the single question as to whether the West still dares to create a goal above itself in its history, or whether it prefers to sink to that level of preservation and enhancement of trade interests and entertainments, to be satisfied with appealing to the status quo as if this were absolute. So Heidegger is saying, okay, Nietzsche's gone, but his situation sort of lives on. And we have the entire Western civilization saying, what is it going to do? Is it going to posit a goal above itself? Or is it just going to be worried about, he says, business interests? Can anyone give me a business interest from the news that's big right now?
Oh, our oil is under your sin.
China is devaluing taking the yuan off the
exactly.
Okay. These are big things. And then entertainment. What was the gross on Wedding Crashers? Right? Wedding Crashers open with Vince Vaughn. These are entertainments, right? That's an entertainment, a movie. So we have a choice. We can either posit a goal that's above us, or we're going to sink down to just worrying about these business interests and what's in the movies. So that's what Heidegger asks. Now, where does Crowley say that goal has to be? Does he say that it has to be for, you know, huge numbers of people for it to be meaningful? No. So the goal is in the individual. Where does Nietzsche say the goal has to be? In the individual, not in the masses of people. So we're left with wondering, you know, are we going to posit a goal that's above ourselves? Now, the only reason I bring this up at the end, and I just want us to consider it, I have a friend who will only date, he's 40, he's my age, who will only date women younger than himself by 20 years or more. Right? Yes, you're laughing. It's not that unheard of, and it's kind of irritating. It's irritating to deal with him about it because he doesn't see it as being as ridiculous as it is. It's like, okay, you're 40 and your girlfriend's 23. Yeah.
What do they talk about?
Well, I don't know how much talk it goes on. It's a whole other issue. But regardless, we haven't been able to get much conversation out of it.
Dad's music.
But here's the problem. Here's the problem. Okay. I'm 40 years old and I'm dating a woman who's 23. Okay. Great. Now, I'm set in my ways. I'm established. I'm 40. I'm who I am. I'm not going to change that much, probably. I mean, I might, but I'm pretty much, you know, who I'm going to be. My 22-year-old girlfriend is just sort of, it's like new to the world. Like the dew is still wet on her ears. So if I try to have a long-term relationship with her for like more than 4 years, what's going to happen? By the time she's 27, she's not going to be the same person she was when she's 23, and she's going to grow away from me and leave me miserable, calling my friend, who's also 40, wondering why his 27-year-old girlfriend has dumped him and why he cannot find happiness in love. This is going to happen. Okay? Now, I bring this up only because if we posit goals that are above ourselves, we can change, and we'll still have the same goal. Right? So a transcendent goal is one that is unchanging. We may change, the goal stays the same. So if someone says to you, well, how can you have a goal that's above yourself? How can I have any serious goal that's going to change as I change? That's not a goal, that's just the status quo. So do you see what Heidegger's doing here? He's going back to this hierarchy again. So he's saying there has to be a hierarchy. There has to be something up in this place. But if it's higher, what is it going to be? Terrible. Great and terrible. Can we have a great goal that is not terrible? Nope. Now, how does this relate to Thelema? I mean, here's Heidegger telling us, here's Nietzsche telling us, the hierarchy is still there. We can even be pagans, not Llewellyn pagans, not Renfair pagans, but real pagans, and we can conceive of beings higher than ourselves, but they're also immoral. I would posit that the HGA, that most experience that most people have, is meeting with a being that is higher than them, but immoral. The Iwas, if we're like, you know, Thelemites, we're going to go, Iwas is a higher being than us. Crowley says this in Magic Without Tears. This woman's like, I can't handle the morality of Weaver Hal. I just don't like it. And Crowley says, I don't like it either. None of us like it. But Iwas isn't arguing with us. He's not trying to persuade us. He's just telling us. That's the way it is. Now, to me, that seems exactly like the kind of figure Nietzsche is talking about, a being higher than we are, but terrible. Higher, great, in a lot of ways, but terrible. So, in goal setting again, looking back on this, how many people think they're going to reincarnate and come back as Thelemites? I do, unfortunately. I will have to do this forever. I'm like in a billion-year contract with the Scientologists. I'm not getting out of it. You know, no matter what happens, I'm not getting out of it. So I have a goal that seems to me to be above even this incarnation, which is interesting. You know, some directing force which is above. But it's also not that nice in a lot of ways. Great, but terrible. Big, but deep and profound, but not nice. So this, I'm offering this Nietzschean stuff to you guys to say, is there something to this? And are people having a problem approaching Thelema because of what Nietzsche is telling us about it? And that's it. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
I hope you enjoyed the lecture, and I look forward to your feedback and questions. The outgoing song today is from an artist called Agrippa 93, and the song is Forgotten Will. One quick note. I'm going on vacation to New England in 2 weeks, so there may be a delay for the next show. Stay tuned and subscribed. I promise it will not be too long before number 11 appears. Oh, one other thing. If you do have a website or a blog, please consider putting a link to Thelema Coast to Coast on it, or using the Thelema Coast to Coast banner. The banner can be seen at the bottom of the Thelema Coast to Coast website. Thanks for your support and listening. Love's the law, love under will.